Okay. Well, hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I'm delighted to have Daniel Wiseman with me this afternoon talking about his great new book called The Last Songbird. Welcome, Daniel. It's great to finally meet you. And
yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah. Let me just give you a little, I'm going to read your author blurb here. It says, Daniel Wiseman is a writer and editor whose work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Billboard, The Guardian, the AP Newswire, and more. Under the nom de plume Shredder, Wiseman also wrote for the long-running Flipside fanzine, as well as LA Weekly, which once called him an incomparable punk stylist. Most recently, Wiseman co-authored Game Changer by Michael Solomon and Rashawn Bloomberg. He lives in Los Angeles. And we were just talking a little bit of, before we got started about, you know, punk rock and some of our shared love of music. And
Jodie Foster's Army.
And Jodie Foster's Army, right. Arizona institution. Still going strong, too. But we're going to talk about all sorts of things here. But music actually does loom heavily in the background of this new book. And I was just telling Daniel that a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I went out to LA to see this, a couple of things, but this wonderful concert commemorating, it was out in Glendale at the, I think it was the Alex?
Yeah, the Alex Theater.
Theater, this wonderful old Art Deco theater, but it was commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Nuggets album compilation, which is, you know, Lenny Kay put it together and, you know, it had The Seeds and Love and 13th Floor Elevators and lots of wonderful kind of one hit wonders of, you know, garage rock and psychedelia. And but the reason I bring it up is because in the audience was packed with all these interesting characters that kind of came out of the LA's woodwork, you know, that obviously were involved in that scene back in the 60s. Yeah. And so it was just overrun with all these great eccentric characters. And, you know, it's actually kind of an appropriate segue to begin talking about your book in some ways. And as we get started, I love the cover design. I thought it was so, you know, evocative. And it works on so many different levels. You know, we get the view of the woman in the rear view mirror. And that is largely how this book is told. You know, we learn about what happened to her through the rear view mirror. And we also get bits and pieces of what happened to Addie, your protagonist. Why don't you, before I keep yakking on forever, why don't you tell us a little bit about maybe just a brief setup about the book, and then we can kind of dig in a little bit deeper.
Well, I've been trying to write a mystery since the age of 15. You know, I was raised on Spurdvac, which was like a little club you could belong to when I was like 8, 9, 10. You could trade these little reel-to-reels of old-time radio shows. And I used to trade The Saint with Vincent Price and Dragnet and stuff like that, you know. and then I discovered the Chandler paperbacks, and it was all over. You know, I fell in love with them. The 70s, I actually keep them on my desk here. I'm talking about the ones that have these kinds of covers.
Right.
You know, so you can see they're all torn up now. But anyway, at 15, I remember starting and trying to write a mystery, and I kept hitting a dead end. I tried again at 26. You know, I was already doing music journalism, other kinds of journalism, and other kinds of storytelling too. But with the mystery, I kept getting snagged because I kept sort of trying to plot. You know, I was like lost in the net of plotting. And then about 7, 8 years ago, I knew I wanted to write about a driver, and originally it was going to be like a limo driver, because to write about LA, I feel like you have to really be behind the wheel to write about the way it's experienced, right?
Right.
But so I had a manuscript about a limo driver that wasn't really working. I was struggling with it. And then this Uber and Lyft culture just blossomed before me. And I'd been gone from LA for about 18 years. I moved back, and I think Lyft and Uber were just getting started. And within 2 years, it was like a thing everywhere. And I was like, that's my protagonist, you know, it's just a regular person behind the wheel. And he is a failed songwriter, which is something that I have some personal experience with, a failed music journalist. And he picks up his idol or one of his idols, and they form a bond. And that's the story. The rest, I mean, I won't say it just all fell into place, but once I had those two sparks, it was easy to chase.
And the woman in question, the last songbird, tell us a little bit about who she is. It seems like there are lots of different elements in there. You know, people think of Joni Mitchell, and you know, I got kind of a Karen Dalton, Sandy Denny,
nice,
you know, Janice Ian. You know, all these different songwriters come to mind.
There's so many great ones from that era, and I.
Dusty Springfield,
Lori Lieberman, who wrote Killing Me Softly. Ricky Lee Jones is a huge presence to me, you know.
Marianne Faithfull, maybe a little bit.
Marianne Faithfull, and also Michelle Phillips, who was my high school alma mater.
Before
me by several years. But, you know, one thing I should say is that character is somebody who is not, I mean, she's a singer-songwriter, but her spirit is embodied by people who are also not singer-songwriters. Like Mary McCarthy, the writer, was kind of an influence, and Susan Sontag. I'm talking about any post-war liberated woman who is so powerful and so brilliant that she has this like bright blue flame and everybody around her is in awe, right? I chose the name Annie because of Dreamboat Annie from Heart.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, just because that album to me is almost like the apotheosis of that kind of soul music. But anyway.
Right. So Annie Linden is her name.
Yeah.
And as I said, she exists in the novel through the rearview mirror. There are all in flashback. You know, it's very classic, kind of reminds me of elements of Chandler and elements of Ross McDonald in particular, you know. Were those some of those classic LA writers influences on you? You mentioned Chandler.
I have my little, I don't know what you call it, my little shrine here of Mr. McDonald, Mr. Chandler, and some other, you know, great LA writers too, you know.
Yeah.
Joan Didion, obviously, and also some Jewish writers that aren't LA people, like Isaac Babel, who wrote the Benya Crick gangster stories, and some of Saul Bellow's early work, like Augie March, where they're all like city people.
Right.
They're all like a little bent, you know.
Well, then Jerome Sharon, do you know his stuff?
I don't know that writer.
He wrote Blue Eyes. Maybe I'm not pronouncing it. Charyn, Jerome. Yeah, fantastic writer. Blue Eyes, and Isaac Seidel was his character, Seidel. Yeah.
That sounds good.
But he was great too. But so, yeah, let's talk, a little bit further about, you know, driving as this sort of LA metaphor. You know, there's this element of, the city is very different in the daytime versus the nighttime, you know, and at night, a very different city emerges. And there's this kind of voyeuristic element of driving around and interacting.
Yeah, it's really indescribable. You know, I lived for about a decade in New York, and all just under a decade in Israel, all over, and spending lots of time in Paris too, because I have cousins there. And all those places have something in common that LA doesn't, or maybe I should say that LA has something that you just don't find anywhere else. It's hard to, I guess the shorthand would be to say like a sense of disconnection. And the driving aspect underscores that. You're always alongside these strangers, but you're in motion.
Right.
And it's very dramatic in a weird way when you realize how weird it is. So I continue to try to capture that in writing, that sense of constant motion, of strangers, of being in a strange place. And at night, it has this whole other aspect because there's very few people on the streets, you know, other than the people that are in cars. So not everywhere, of course. And LA is different now than you know, it's changed over the years, but it's not like what Chicago and New York and Minneapolis have in common. You can't find that here. That sense of a place.
Right. I mean, of course, in Los Angeles is all, you know, a lot of it is surrounding the entertainment industry in Hollywood, which gives it this peculiar, surreality in a lot of ways. And it is interesting that it, you know, LA became one of the epicenters for the hard-boiled detective novel, you know, which if you think about the natural, the Western kind of solitary hero, you know, kind of going against the grain, loner, mythic character. In some ways, it's like LA was the natural place where, you know, he would turn in the horse for the car, you know, and cruise around.
You feel like a lone wolf here, you know. I mean, yeah. You feel like a lone wolf, and you know you're at the end of the nation, and in some ways you're kind of at the end of Western civilization, you know. I mean, without getting too philosophical about it. And then there's also something about the basin, which I only realized after returning to LA, which is that the city is on this ever so slight tilt, so that you get so much more sky in Los Angeles than you do anywhere else. And I think that that has a slightly disorienting, like, you know how in Alaska, when they have Jubilee and the sun finally comes out after 6 months, like everybody goes a little loopy.
Sure.
I think LA has like a year round version of that, where we're all so exposed to the sky in a way that you aren't in other big cities.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that. Huh. Yeah.
I'm not sure what the exact degree of the angle is after the foothills, but it's kind of like the city just keeps going like this, you know?
Well, it's like, you know, you drive 5 minutes and you go through all these different worlds, you know? We stayed this the last time at an Airbnb in this great little community called Lincoln Heights. You know, and it was like right across from Chavez Ravine from Dodger Stadium.
Yeah.
And this little canyon, and it was just like this unpretentious kind of.
Yeah.
It was very cool. And the city's like that, you know, it's just all these different elements on top of one another. And, you know,
it's very strange. You turn a corner and it's like a whole different culture, a whole different class, a whole different.
Yep.
Sometimes looking across the street. So.
Right. You know, and just to talk a little bit about the music, you know, you think of Laurel Canyon, you know, and you think of that whole scene in the 60s. There's been a lot of, you know, documentaries about that, you know, Frank Zappa and just all the people, the Byrds and Joni Mitchell. And we talked a little bit about Love. That whole scene has been so romanticized over the years. I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about when you were kind of putting together?
Yeah, I mean, it's beyond, like, for me, it's, you know, it's beyond romantic. It's, you know, I had an older brother, 15 years older than me, who was a hippie, you know?
Right.
And so when I was a little kid growing up here, you know, I saw a lot of that stuff firsthand, you know, tagging along with him in his convertible MG. And it's the bright side and the dark side of it. And there was a lot of freedom. And I myself was a latchkey kid. You know, the parents were like the parents on Charlie Brown. You know, you like heard them, but you never saw them, you know, we were really left to our own devices.
Right.
So, and there was a real sense of decay in the 70s too, that the city had kind of been abandoned and it was like a cow town. So there was this romantic utopian hippie thing. There was the crazy hyper spiritualized thing. And there was the decay, and there was the Hollywood facade. So all those things are like swimming around each other. And if you, you know, you couldn't make sense of it, but you could try to swim in it, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, LA has always had this really interesting kind of almost like an occult underbelly to it, or an occult vibe to it, you know? And the way you just describe it is so spot on. You know, you think about these sort of utopian, almost, well, cults, certainly there were no shortage of cults in Hollywood and in LA. Health food stores and Brian Wilson, and then the Manson family, and then, you know, all these different elements thrown together.
Yeah, I grew up not too far from some of that Manson stuff. Some of the girls propositioned my brother to go up to the ranch, which he thankfully turned them down. Wow. But also in the punk days, me and my junior high friends would go to a store on Hollywood Boulevard that was called Hermetic Occult Supplies. And they would have these like little bottles of spells and stuff, you know? So it was probably not a safe environment for young people, but that's where we were.
Well, you know, and then back in the 20s and 30s, you know, it was like, and even the 40s, you know, it was like thousands and thousands of pretty girls from, you know, coming from Iowa or the Midwest were arriving at Hollywood and Vine, anxious to make their start, to become successful. And it didn't always work out, did it? I mean,
by the punk days, a lot of those people, including some who had even had some screen time, were like crazy bag ladies. You know, Reagan changed the laws about mental health. I can't remember the exact details, but I think he closed down a bunch of halfway houses, and all of a sudden you just had complete luck in the streets of Hollywood, including some people that, you know, could claim that I was an extra in that Gene Autry movie.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, I actually wrote this down to bring it up because there was this wonderful memoir that came out, I think it was in the 90s, called Lowdown. And it was by a jazz pianist, Joe Albany's daughter. And she's talks about living in LA in the 1980s, I think, mainly in like these old crappy kind of hotel / rooming houses.
Yeah.
In that time, you know, they were packed with aging, you know, has been actresses and actors and from the 20s and the 30s. And you know, interacting with them, and what a fascinating time that would have been, you know.
Yeah, I guess that is really a central to the book, which is that LA is a city of dreamers, you know, and people whose dreams can get very rabid. And there's also something, and this is definitely part of what drew me to that material, that there's something crazy making about being so close to the action.
Yes.
You know, you drive by Capitol Records, you know, if you're a struggling songwriter and you drive by Capitol Records and you drive by Gold Star Studios, which isn't around anymore, but you know, you're always like one hiccup away from the dream becoming a reality. But of course, you know, that isn't so, but that's the illusion sort of.
Right. So Addy, you know, as you said, he's sort of, how old is he? Late 30s?
37, yeah. Which is Philip Marlowe's age. I chose it because it was Philip Marlowe's age.
Oh, really? 37?
Yeah. For all books except the very last one. I think in The Long Goodbye, he becomes 44 or something.
Right. Although he feels like he's in his mid-50s, right?
Yeah.
but he's, yeah. So Addy's kind of, as you say, he's sort of, what has he done? He's tried to be a recording engineer. He's tried to be a pop critic. He's tried to be his big dream is to be a songwriter. And I love the fact that, you know, he's now, a Lyft driver. And, you know, as you said, this whole, especially pandemic, the last few few years, it's created this whole industry of not just YouTube and Lyft, but Grubhub and this, but he lives in in the storage room of the struggling recording studio, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, it's a dilapidated recording studio on Venice Boulevard, which is, I won't name names, but it's actually, I live like blocks away from this very beautiful aqua blue building that's a recording studio. And I guess I just pictured him there.
Right. And so how does he, we get bits and pieces of the story as you go. How does he happen to first pick up Annie Linden? How does he come in contact with her?
Well, she has to get to the airport the very first time, and she uses the Lyft app, or maybe she has her assistant fire it up for her, but she's standing out there in the loop of her driveway, and he pulls up and he can't believe it. You know, it's like, oh, it's Annie Linden, you know? So they bond on the ride to the airport, they chat, and of course he thinks he's never going to see her again. But the next day he gets a call from her, or not a call, but like through the app, you know, if you lost something in the car, you can ping the driver and say, hey, I lost something. Is there any way I can retrieve it? Right. So she pings him and says, I lost a barrette. But there is no barrette, really. He thinks that really it's just that she's kind of a lonely older woman. And because they hit it off, she, you know, wants to stay connected to him. So from there, they build a relationship. They go off app. He gets her phone number, and he starts kind of becoming her regular driver.
Right. And, you know, I think that he tells her something like, I'm an insomniac with a broken heart, you know, and they both share that bond. And she becomes, you know, almost like she, a lot of different things, you know. She's sort of a surrogate mother figure in a twisted way, you know. When we learn, you give us pieces of his backstory as we go, and we learn that his own mother was all kinds of messed up, you know, and spent the last years of her life, I don't want to give any spoilers, but
yeah,
the last years of her life living out of her car with him. And again, the car features prominently, interestingly, in his backstory. But Annie Linden, yeah, she becomes surrogate mother figure, almost like this twisted romantic surrogate in a way. But also, she's succeeded at the thing that he most wants to do. And I think that's really important.
Absolutely. That is the important, I think. And I think that it's never, you know, he plays her, this won't be a spoiler, I don't think, but he plays her some of his demoed songs.
Right.
And yeah, she's very early on. Super enthused. And she's like, these are really great. These are like diamonds in the rough. You know, she's encouraging. And then she asks him to do some favors, right? And it's never really clear. And to be honest, it's not even clear to me how sincere she is about his songs. And I think that, you know, there might be some level where she just responded to, what a kick it is, my Lyft driver's writing songs.
Right.
But her, to receive a compliment from somebody like that is so powerful that it rocks your world. And I've had a little bit of that. You know, when I was 10 or 11, I was writing poetry. And for some reason, one of my sisters had befriended Miguel Pinheiro, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, right? And he read some of my little 11-year-old poems and was like, oh man, I'm knocked out. This guy's a real poet. You know, he really laid it on thick, you know?
Right.
And to this day, I don't know, was he just saying like, you know, what a trip, the kid is writing poetry? Or did he actually see something there? It doesn't really matter, because the fact that he like injected me with that meant that I couldn't let it go. I had to keep doing it.
Right.
You know? So yeah, getting a little encouragement, a little powerful encouragement from the right person can drive you crazy.
Yeah. And another thing I thought that was really cool about Adam is that he has almost this, Tourette's like, you know, he comes up with these songs and they're wonderful. These little songs that you, and they come like almost, he can't almost control them, seems like, in a way. It's almost like these word association tics, you know, and he, you know, and he's in a great place to be a songwriter, because I think, as he says, you know, each fair, each person he picks up is their own, there's a song in them somewhere.
Yeah. I love that you described it as Tourette's. I never thought of it that way, but that's exactly right. It's like, it's an, what do they call it? An impulse, like where it's a something you can't control, involuntary response or whatever.
It does seem like tics. It's almost like blah, blah, blah. And each word kind of unfolds into another association. And some of the lyrics are very, seem very punk rock, you know? and I love how, I can't think of an example, but there's some great, great hidden, you don't explain where some of these songs come from, but there's a lot of like little chestnuts hidden for people who are music nerds, you know, who'll pick up on, you know, She's Not There is one of them, song, and just the book is full of that kind of thing. It's hard to figure out what to say. Tell us a little. I mean, we learned very early on in the book that there's a murder, and tell us a little bit about that, a little bit about the plot.
Well,
I'll let you say what we can say about it.
Yeah, I was trying to do it without giving anything away. Somebody with that powerful a magnetism does not only bring out the best in those around them. And I think that when it's a woman, it has a whole other dimension to it. And one of the main characters in the book is Annie's assistant, Bix, you know, who he has drug problems and he's desperate. And he's like, he's filled with this ambivalence toward her. It's like, he keeps coming back to her. He keeps getting fired. He writes these angry letters, you know, but he's like, he's stuck on her, you know, in a way that's volatile. And that ambivalence, I think, is like, you know, is maybe like the key to the plot, you know, that a lot of the people around her love her, worship her, idolize her. And they either throw pixie dust on the part they don't want to see, you know, or they're completely stuck and filled with rage about the way that she doesn't fulfill whatever their thing is, right?
Right.
So it was fun. It was fun to write a mystery where the missing person is the hole in the record and everything around them. You know, it's really about the world around them that they inculcate. And I wonder if maybe all of us aren't like that a little bit. You know, there's the person, you know, and each person in a way is a group project where there's, you know, all the people in your life will have a slightly different opinion of you.
Sure.
And actually one of the, well, I'm trying to do this without spoilers, but one of the books he finds in Annie's stack of books is Mary McCarthy's The Company She Keeps. You know, which is, of course, that title is taken from the phrase, if I'm not mistaken, a woman is defined by the company she keeps. You know, but that's not really, I don't think that's really fair. I don't think it's fair to say a person is defined by the company they keep. But I do think that every person has an electricity that goes out to the company they keep. And you can know something about them through that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned there's this sort of theme of absence, you know, that kind of runs throughout. And I was thinking about, we all love the tale of the musician or the artist or the writer who's sort of abandoned the limelight or who's fallen from grace. Or, I mean, we love an acid casualty story.
Right.
And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, I'm a big Syd Barrett fan.
Oh, me too.
And you know, him and Peter Green and people like that. But you think about the album Wish You Were Here, you know, it's all about absence. Mm. It's all about, you know, somebody who's,
yeah,
who's removed, who's gone.
And it's their best album.
Yeah.
Well, maybe after Saucer Full of Secrets.
Or Piper at the Gates of Dawn. That was the that was the Syd Barrett one. But no, there's this whole, and you know, I don't know if I have a question for him, but I'm thinking about the wonderful character, Double Fry, Ephraim Freiberger.
Ephraim Freiberger, yeah.
Yeah, he used to be a lawyer, right, an attorney, and he lives on a boat, very, very California.
I don't remember if it's stayed in the final manuscript, but what I had was he was working at his mom's firm, and he got fired for smoking pot on his lunch break.
That's great. Yeah. Now he's a photographer, but now he's part of that industry that you're talking about, that kind of not a parasite necessarily, but it's sort of you know, there's that whole industry that sort of bottom feeds on the entertainment business.
Yeah, he's like somebody trying to make a quick buck, and he knows how to take pictures, so he's a paparazzi, you know.
Right.
But he's also gravitating toward greater religious observance, you know, which is really based on a close friend of mine, but also the world he introduced me to of the Happy Minyan, which is these deadheads that are like really into Torah, you know. So that I thought that was like a very unique to LA kind of subculture, where it's like people are trying to blend the utopian 60s with religious observance. So
yeah, interesting. But then there's also, and again, not to give too many spoilers away, but so I mean, this is all in the very beginning of the book, but so yeah. Bix is immediately kind of arrested as the main suspect in Annie Linden's murder, and also in Troy, another one of her kind of associates that lives in and around this really interesting sort of compound. Wouldn't you say that's what it is?
Her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's well, it's, you know, not typical, but for the super wealthy Malibu. I have a, my wife is a floral designer, and I have a kind of afternoon gig delivering flowers for her. So sometimes she does a bunch of celebrities and stuff. So sometimes I get behind the gates at these places that under other circumstances you wouldn't. And that property is definitely based on, you know, one of those kind of Malibu beachside places where there's a house, but then there's also a guest house, but then there's also a beach house, and then there's also a pool house. You know, it's like more than any human person could ever need.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so Bix is the one that they immediately arrest for these murders. Addie has sort of a complicated attitude towards Bix. And so what makes him want to investigate this story further?
Well, first he just knows in his gut that Bix is not guilty. You know, there's something too gentle and innocent about Bix. Despite the fact that he's got all these problems and he's neurotic, he just doesn't seem like somebody who would go to that crazy extreme. But also, as he investigates further, this is the last spoiler I'll give. He becomes an accomplice after the fact. Addie himself does. So, you know, at that point, he has to exonerate Bix, because if Bix gets busted, then he's going to really be in trouble.
Right. And Bix tells him, you got to go in and get these letters that, you know, that she kept in her filing cabinet that could be very damning.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, so Addie's investigation, you know, takes him all over the place and into some pretty dark places. And one of them, I think we can bring up the topic anyway, is these men's rights groups. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of world?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, like, you know, if if Ricky Lee Jones and Carole King and Stevie Nicks represent like the zenith of like a certain kind of female liberation, right? What is the force that would stop that, that would resent it most, that would want to control it most, you know? And that world of men's rights, you know, definitely exists. I mean, I don't know if it's in full flower now, but at the time that I was writing it, it was very easy to find that stuff. At different levels, you know, which I kind of have in the book. There's some guys that are just like looking for, you know, how to pick up girls, you know? And then there's some people who have a much more malevolent, whole like philosophical angle about why women need to be controlled, or, you know, why females have destroyed our culture because they've been let loose or whatever. So, you know, that's all there.
The red pill and all that kind of.
Yeah, the red pill.
That kind of stuff.
It seems to be politicized, although yeah, actually it does seem to be politicized more than ever now, more than when I was writing the book.
Like the Proud Boys and all those kind of movements.
Yeah, I think that they have, I can't speak for them and I don't know that much about it, but I feel like there is a subculture out there who has a very specific attitude about women that is somehow the dead opposite of these powerful poetesses that I'm talking about.
Right. Right. They feel very threatened by them, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's next for you? Are you going to write another book with this character, or is that?
Yeah. It's funny that you talked about Nuggets, because the second Adam Zanz mystery is called Cinnamon Girl, and it's in like later stages of a draft.
Wow.
And I don't want to say too much about it, but I will say that it involves a very underground, little known Paisley Underground band.
Oh.
And as you probably know, the Paisley Underground was an attempt in the early 80s to revive that mid-60s.
The Strawberry Alarm Clock and
style and culture and whatever, you know, and I was like around for some of that, and the kids were super devotional. I mean, we would go to thrift stores and study those records. They were like scripture to us,
right?
You know, so in the second Adam Zanz mystery, he finds an acetate of a record that never comes out, and the mystery unravels from there.
I love it. That sounds great. Didn't the Bangles get their start in that scene?
The Bangles were the Bangs when they got started.
Bangs, right.
There was the Salvation Army. They became 3 o'clock. Green on Red.
Red Cross.
Red Cross, the Unknowns. There was a whole, it wasn't really one thing. It was like, there was kind of an attempt to redress the 60s, you know?
Yeah.
You can even say the Gun Club, like some of the roots rock, you know.
I love the Gun Club.
Yeah, me so too. Good. So it was a very exciting time, but it was also a time of close nostalgia. You know, I mean, back then in 1982 or whatever, the 60s were, you know, 10 years ago.
Right. But
people were already longing for them. So that's part of the story.
Fascinating. Yeah. Do you have plans kind of to keep going beyond that, or?
I do. I have a summary of the third one. We'll see where it goes.
Excellent. Now, I'd asked you at the beginning, tell us a little bit about some of the music journalism you've done. Shredder was your nom de plume.
Yeah.
So what kind of things did you do?
I started as a teenager and I did a fanzine, you know, just with my friends in junior high. We, you know, in those days you could like, I want to interview Keith Morris of the Circle Jerks. You'd open up the phone book, you go to Keith Morris and you'd see like, oh, this one must be him because he's over in Hermosa. You know, you'd call, his mom would answer and say, he's not home right now, but give me your number and he'll call you back. Right. And then he'd call back and there were these little suction cups you would stick on the phone and plug them into a Panasonic tape recorder, you know, so we conducted our interviews like that. And I did that for a while, but I didn't have a photographer or anything. So I was actually stealing photos from other zines.
Really?
Including Flipside. And one day Al from Flipside called me up and he was just like, stop stealing the photos, man. I'll give you some extras. We have extra photos, right? And then he said, well, or if you want, you can write for us too, you know? So then I started writing for them. And from there, I went on to the LA Weekly and did a lot of stuff.
Wow. Did you ever write for Maximum Rock and Roll?
I didn't, but they were certainly a giant force to be reckoned with.
Right.
With controversial, they're out of San Francisco, I think.
Were they?
I don't know. I'm not sure. My punk expert friends would know, but yeah, they were one of the biggies. That whole world was so incredible. And I, you know, now that we're in this internet age, we have a lot of cool advantages and everything, but to be able to make something, Xerox it, distribute it, and also start to communicate through the US mail with people. You know, I'd write little LA updates for Touch and Go, which is out of Michigan, and Church of the Latter-day Punks in New York, you know? And I'd come home to like 7-8 pieces of mail every day in those days.
Wow.
People sending records and fan letters and, you know, just goofy, crazy stuff. It was an underground society that was really indescribable. And
it was tiny.
And it was tiny. I mean, it was even tinier before my era. You know, I came in that mid period before it broke nationally. I think originally it was like 1,000 people in LA, you know, but then the younger generation came in and became like 10,000 people.
And then, of course, later in the 90s that, you know, Offspring and all that kind of stuff came in.
Yeah, I was already.
Yeah, me too.
A self-declared old man by then. I was, yeah. You know, I was out of touch with it. But it's the U.S. mail and that world of print is such a magical thing that I it's hard to capture. It's hard to describe, you know, to younger people that didn't see it firsthand. There was a weirdness about it. You know, you'd go into a record store, you had to get on a bus to go to this other neighborhood to go to a record store, and they would have 10 records for sale and three fanzines and 2 t-shirts. That's all they had, you know, but you felt like, wow, everything here is imbued.
There was a place like that here in Phoenix or Tempe, really, by the university. It's this little record store called Roads to Moscow. And
I think it's been there a long time, right?
It's long gone now. I think it didn't survive the 80s. But my little 13-year-old self or whatever would go there and pick up all those early, you know, singles like the JFA one you mentioned.
Yeah.
And there was, I wish I had some of these, you know. There was the first Meat Puppets single. And I remember I didn't know what the hell to make of that. I wasn't ready for that.
It was noisy. It was very noisy.
I wasn't ready for that.
There's a guy named Ryan Richardson, who is in Texas, I believe, who is the premier Southern California punk collector. And he's got everything. I mean, he's got multiple copies of everything.
Right.
And he came out here and he made good scans of my fanzines. And that was really cool. So.
Yeah, I love TSOL, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, me too.
Well, we can go down into the weeds with this. But, Daniel, it's been a real treat talking with you. And
same here.
Everybody, The Last Songbird, fantastic book. I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And let's stay in touch, Daniel. I'll get your information from Michael.
That'd be great.
Sounds good. We'll talk to you soon.
Awesome.
Take care now.
Bye all.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.